welcome to Back in Control Radio with Dr. David Hanscom.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Back in Control Radio with Dr. David Hanscom. I'm your host, Tom Masters, and our guest today is Melissa Farmer. She's a rare combination of pain psychologist and neuroscientist. She's spent 16 years working with patients with hard-to-treat chronic pain. She's also worked for 8 years with world-renowned neuroscientist Dr. Vanya Apkarian on groundbreaking research studies of chronic pain. She's co-founder of AVO Health with Dr. Apkarian, where their mission is bringing effective and compassionate pain care to people who need it. Welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Melissa, welcome to the show. I'm excited that you're here. And I'm going to give a little introduction here. And she is quite talented. She works with one of the leading neuroscientists in the world. She also has her own reputation in her own realm. But she's one of about five people in the U.S. who is both a pain psychologist and a neuroscientist. She's worked with people for 16 years treating chronic pain. And she trained at one of the few multidisciplinary clinics in North America at McGill University. And what really is impressive, Dr. Vanya Apkarian is considered one of the original pioneers in the pain world, documenting the MRI scan findings in chronic low back pain. So Dr. Apkarian has talked to her group. He's a really remarkable person, quite precise. Is that the word, Melissa?
Yes.
So I'm excited to get some of your insights from spending time with him one-on-one, which is going to be incredible. But just like a little bit of a background to as how you arrived to where you're at now. So you're a pain psychologist. And so are you in private practice or in a group practice, or are you mostly working with AVO Health?
I'm mostly working with AVO Health. And in fact, most of my work has been through research.
Okay. And I'm just going to jump ahead of the story and work backwards. So those of us who work in the chronic pain world, I was trained as a surgeon, and we generally think chronic pain is unsolvable. There's something to be managed, et cetera. The data shows only about 20% of physicians are comfortable treating chronic pain or managing it, and less than 1% enjoy it. And there's an increasing group of clinicians who are seeing people just go to pain-free, and it happens on a regular basis. But it's looking at the physiology of pain, not the structure. And then, of course, your world is looking at the research MRI scans of the brain and looking at what's going on there. So your background was in psychology or neuroscience first?
Clinical psychology and behavioral neuroscience. I did essentially a double degree.
Okay.
Graduate school. And okay. And what the model at McGill there was very much entrenched in uniting the basic science and the clinical study of pain from the classic perspective.
Right.
Which means much more focused on the peripheral physiology, on inflammation, on changes in the spinal cord, as if pain stopped at the spinal cord and you know, very little consideration for how the information is processed from the cortical, the brain aspect.
So this is not a fair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Yeah. Can you give us a few just highlights of your research or some things that you have found out personally, you and Dr. Apkarian together? What are some of your insights into the nature of chronic pain?
I think what would be of most interest to the people who are listening right now is that the brain dynamically changes in response to all of the symptoms and all of your daily experiences with pain. And I observed this in people with chronic pelvic pain of different types, mostly diagnoses of exclusion. It's my personal specialty. So that's interstitial cystitis, non-specific low back pain, which is a huge group of people, fibromyalgia, vulvodynia, chronic pelvic pain, irritable bowel syndrome. And what we view from that perspective is changes in the function and structure of the brain as the pain experience evolves over time.
Okay.
So the brain is never static. That's one of the most important things that my personal research has shown. But also it seems to track very closely with the symptoms.
Okay.
And although my research didn't show this, there is research showing that this is reversible, which is a message I really want to reinforce whenever we're talking about anything about the brain. Your brain cares about what happened in the last month, what's happening now, and what's about to happen. So you always have the ability to shift what your brain is focusing on.
Right. And so what I found out, and again, we didn't actually really know this in medical school, is that we thought the brain was sort of a fixed structure and it just atrophied over time, and that your brain didn't really change that much. So we really had no concept about neuroplasticity at all in medical school. And what we found out, the brain changes by the second.
Yeah.
And it's a very physiological structure. And what I just learned, which again, I'm supposed to learn this a long time ago, is that half the brain is the immune system. The glial cells are all inflammatory markers on them, and they're connected to the vagus nerve. And so the group out of Stanford that looks at the brain as part of the immune system, there's the innate immune system that we're born with. There's the adaptive immune system that we develop as we have different exposure to different threats, you know, viruses and bacteria. And then they put the brain into the protective immune system, which keeps you away from danger. And so it's sort of a surveillance thing. But anyway, the brain itself becomes very inflamed. So let me ask you a question. There's a very famous, at least in my world, there's a very significant paper by, I think his name is pronounced Hashmi, about how physical pain shifts to the emotional centers in about 6 to 12 months.
Yes.
Were you involved in that research? I know you're familiar.
Yes, I helped collect data for that study. Yeah, okay. That's when I first got into Dr. Apkarian's laboratory as a postdoctoral fellow. And it was a massive study. So like the whole research lab, we were working, we were scanning for 12 hours a day, tons of people coming in to get this really rich data, because what we were able to do. So let me give you a little bit of a background for that study. We first found people who were experiencing low back pain within the first 2 to 3 months of developing pain. And so that was, we were interested in understanding if we can scan their brains at baseline and a few time points over the next year, can we use these brain scans, functional magnetic resonance imaging, structural imaging, and also DTI to look at the white matter changes, can we predict who is going to have pain in a year? And so we scanned people 6 times over a year, did a lot of testing to look at the psychological characteristics, the behavioral characteristics. And one of the interesting things is for that particular study, none of the initial psychology predicted who would have pain. It was how the brain regions were communicating. So I'm dipping over into Beliki 2012, the mesocortical circuit finding, where it was the amount of the communication between the nucleus accumbens and the medial prefrontal cortex. So this is the reward brain region and emotional learning, how much they were communicating, that predicted who would have pain a year later.
Can I back up just for a second for the audience? So can you define a functional MRI scan for people, what it actually does and what it's looking at?
Sure. It looks at how oxygen use changes in the brain over a matter of seconds. That's a very, very basic definition of it. So you get to see on the order of, 2 to 5 seconds, how quickly brain changes or oxygen use changes. That corresponds with glucose use.
Okay.
So essentially, where is energy being used in your brain?
Okay.
A proxy measure for where activity is happening.
So a functional MRI scan shows brain activity, not just the structure. Mm-hmm. My understanding is like 9 different types of functional MRI scans, maybe more now.
Yeah, there are many types. So
what's measuring what?
So in all of the functional magnetic resonance imaging scans, they all measure activity, but they use different, it's different amounts of researchers' models that go into it. So for example, task-based is, we're going to ask you to focus on this pattern of stimuli in this pattern. And it's almost like you have a hypothesis. We're going to expect brain activity to correspond with the stimulus onset and offset. That's limited because it's limited by the researcher's brain, what they think is going to happen and when. And one of the really cool things about Dr. Apkarian's research is he has used that, but he also steps back from that And he created actually a new kind of brain scan model, task model, that uses a person's individual perception of their pain from moment to moment based on how they use a very simple finger device to rate pain from a little to a lot. So whenever your fingers are together, that's a little, you know, no pain. And whenever your fingers are wide apart, that's a lot of pain. And so he had people rate their pain dynamically over just 10 minutes to get brain activity maps unique to that person.
Okay.
Wow. Their brain was changing as their pain increased and decreased. And there's so much variation, even just over 10 minutes.
Okay.
So you get these really nice fluctuations and you use that as a map to find, to search for brain activity that increases and decreases in relation to that individual's pain.
I see. Interesting. So anyway, the functional, so just to be clear to the audience, so the brain runs on glucose.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a basic sugar, and there's different types of sugar, but the final product is glucose. And so by measuring glucose uptake, you can tell which part of the brain is active versus not, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So the study I like to, because I want to spend a huge amount of time in the second study about predicting chronic pain.
Yeah.
So I want to really focus on the study about where the nociceptive pain switched to the emotional circuits in about 6 to 12 months.
Yes.
I quote Hashmi's paper all the time, so I want to make sure I'm quoting it correctly. So could you give us an overview of that study?
Sure. So it was using the same data set as the Velikyi 2012 information. So it's this, it's again, these people who had pain for 2 to 3 months at the beginning. And what we did is we looked over time in approximately 4 month increments over the course of a year to look for how the brain changes its representation of the perception of pain. So again, this is the data of people rating their pain. So this is each person's individual self-defined pain experience was used here. And what we did is we had group averages. So we, you know, took everyone's personal brain map, averaged them together to find the similarities. And at the very beginning, the perception of pain mapped really well onto what is often called in the pain literature, the pain matrix, which is the acute nociceptive pattern of pain. So it would look very similar to if you had a burning stimulus on your arm, or if you, you know, stubbed your toe. That's the kind of pain that would be active most in the, you know, first 2 to 3 months. So it was still normal acute pain at the very beginning. That's what the brain was processing, which means it was mostly sensory. And then over the course of the year, it starts to shift. To understand how this was shifting, the Hashmi study did something interesting, because she used Javeria Hashmi, who was the primary person working with Vanya on that study, looked at how much that group map compared with other things we know about, for instance, the reward map. So the reward map in the brain is a lot of areas related to the processing of emotion and reward, for instance, the nucleus accumbens, some medial prefrontal cortex, but other areas of the prefrontal cortex as well. And so you look over time at how similar the pain map is with this reward map. Okay. And there was also a sensory map over time too. So in a sense, you're looking at the similarity. How much does you know, this group averaged pain map look like these other known maps, brain maps? And over the course of time, the pain maps in the people who developed chronic pain over the course of the year began to look more and more like the reward maps, meaning that the pain that they were experiencing was increasingly being processed. It was the activity map looked more and more like reward functioning in the brain.
But it was pain.
It was pain.
Okay.
Which is one of the most, which is one of the most, well, and it's one of the most fascinating things about that set of studies, because what it means is that over time, the cognitive, the emotional, the perception of pain first is sensory, which we all understand. And then over time, there are other older brain regions that start to take over the sensory perception of that pain.
Okay.
These are older brain regions in the subcortex that work with emotion.
Okay.
In a sense, it's almost as if the responsibility for processing pain is shift over to these older brain regions that the brain can rely on to free up space to where you can function from day to day and handle new information. Because if your brain is constantly processing acute sensory information, those areas won't be open to new threats. So it's almost an adaptive shift to these older brain habit regions.
So I want to make sure I'm quoting this correctly. So the way, first of all, in medical school we're taught, don't worry about back pain because it always goes away. Mm-hmm. So they apply that maybe 10% of the time it becomes chronic. So if you recall in this HASHB study that they start out with acute pain, less than 2 or 3 months, and half the patients had the pain resolved and half the patients actually went on to chronic pain. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot. 50% of people with an acute back injury went on to chronic pain. That's way different than I was taught in medical school. Mm-hmm. Then all I say is that I say, look, the activity in the brain goes from the nociceptive center or the pain center to the emotional regions. So you have the same pain, but a different driver. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, that's basically it.
It's very orthopedic, I know.
And the word driver, is very classic, but it, in another sense, it's how I like to explain it is that the emotional regions of the brain have taken over responsibility for the sensory perception of pain.
I got it.
Which means that whenever they're experiencing the back pain in their body,
right. It's
no longer the sensory regions that are maintaining the perception. It's these emotional learning regions. And another way of looking at this is that after you've had pain for 6 months or 12 months or decades, the pain is no longer just sensory. Every single day, you are learning how to move differently. You're learning how to change your motivation. You're backing off from things that hurt. You're making decisions about what will be rewarding with the idea that relief is the biggest reward.
Right.
What do? You pull back from things. You stop moving as much. You become very aware, very cautious of what you decide to do because there may be consequences.
Right.
So it in a sense, chronic pain is no longer sensory. It's the sensation plus this whole worldview of what movement is safe, what emotions are safe to have, what emotions will protect you right now. What is your model of the world? Do you feel like the world is a safe place or is the world maybe full of potential danger? And all of that becomes part of the chronic pain experience, which is why the brain areas that are best for handling that, you know, multi-sensory, multi-dimensional perception of pain is the subcortex. It's the emotional brain regions.
So listen, what I want to do, I'm going to do another podcast with you on what to do about this. I mean, what your particular approach is. Mm-hmm. I'd like to really do a little bit longer podcast today on what you're talking about, because this is really critical. Because most of us in medicine, and you know, my personal vision, one of my missions in life is to bring medicine in general, symptoms, illness, and diseases back into the physiological realm, not a structural realm. I mean, autoimmune disorders, what are those? I mean, there's structural changes, but what caused those was inflammation, which is physiology. Mm-hmm. So as you know, medicine's gone down a terrible rabbit hole, especially in spine surgery, where we're doing surgery on normally aging spines, because that's, quote, the pain generator, when those normally aging spines have been documented to not be the pain generator. So listen, I'd like to just finish this out because I'm really curious about this other predictor of chronic pain, which is a huge deal for me, is that, and I'm going to simplify things again and then we'll go back higher again, is that after 6 or 12 months, the pain in your brain becomes memorized. And then your definition, Dr. Mansour is in your lab also, correct?
Yes, yes.
So I quote him all the, is it he or she?
Ali Mansour.
Okay, so I quote him all the time is that the definition of chronic pain from your lab is that it's a memorized set of circuits that becomes connected with more and more life experiences, and the memory cannot be erased. That's the definition I quote all the time in my lectures, et cetera. And am I correct, that's just one sentence out of many. Is that a correct perception?
Yes, and I think a simple way to conceive that for patients, for instance, who are listening becomes an emotional memory.
Right, which makes it more intense.
Yes.
Right, and as you know, my story, I was in chronic pain myself for 15 years. I had 17 physical and mental symptoms, and it was a disaster. Back pain was part of it. It's mostly the anxiety that made me crazy. And so when you talk about this emotional experience, this is starting to make a little bit more sense to me, is that I had physical pains, physical symptoms. I also had migraines, ringing in my ears, burning in my feet, skin rashes, and the anxiety was intolerable. But again, you start becoming hyper vigilant on everything. And you may not have heard me say this before, but you know, we have a fight or flight response or threat physiology that's a million times stronger than your conscious brain. And my cat has the same reaction. So avoiding this fight or flight sensation is what we do to stay alive. So humans have a word for that called anxiety. So anxiety is really a physiological state. And when you can't solve the problem, you become angry, which is a higher physiological state. So we're trying to get rid of the word anxiety. It's just a driving force of all human behavior. So we're using activated threat physiology and hyperactivated threat physiology. So then you can't really, the brain's complicated. I mean, we're being really simplistic here. So as I'm hearing you, again, reminded of this whole definition of chronic pain, it's a memorized set of circuits that become more and more connected with life experiences. So you have a physical component, you have a nociceptive component, then the emotional component is a big deal, because in my mind, thoughts and different sensory input are input, and emotions are your physiology, what you feel. Mm-hmm. And so we tend to think very simplistically in medicine about structure being the cause of the situation. And once you have the pain centralized in the brain, what you do surgically is not going to make any difference at all. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming this model goes into phantom limb pain. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
So have you studied phantom limb pain also? I know San Diego is a big place for it.
I actually have. My personal work on phantom limb pain was doing things to evoke the phantom sensation in people by manipulating their phantom, the neuroma, the phantom, okay, the residual limbs, to try to re-evoke the phantom sensation experimentally with fMRI, which we were able to do, but it was just in the pilot phases.
Okay. So, but essentially, just for the audience, phantom limb pain is you amputate an arm or a leg. Mm-hmm. It's usually painful before you amputate it. That's why you amputate it. And 55% of people have the same pain they had before the amputation. Mm-hmm. So this quote source of the pain is completely gone, mm-hmm, and the pain is still there. And that's a big deal. And I learned that in medical school, but nobody ever really explained that. So I'm assuming you're seeing the similar changes on functional MRI scan with phantom limb pain as you do with almost any chronic pain. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, although different chronic pain conditions each have a little bit of a quirk to them. So there are some differences between, they all have emotional recruitment, but there are little tweaks and differences. So there are always a few changes, you know, for instance, between something that, for instance, knee osteoarthritis, which impacts movement much more than, for instance, irritable bowel syndrome, which is more internalized.
Right. So
there's some, you know, some tweaks, but yes, that's essentially right. And one of the reasons why phantom limb pain is always the thing that's brought up is because the structural source of the pain is gone, and yet the pain remains. And the only place where that pain can live that makes sense physiologically is in the brain.
Correct. And what doctors do, which is really unfair, it's a quote psychological issue. That's just simply not true at all.
Oh yeah. The and I think one of my, this is a source of personal frustration, because I think the word psychological has been weaponized.
Right.
Because if you look back in the history of medicine, the word psychosomatic was weaponized for a long time, just in that if you don't have some sort of test result, some sort of scan that proves to me why you have pain, you're making it up.
Right.
Which is the old way of doing things.
Right.
And
it's
one of the things
so common.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons why I've always loved Vanya's research also is that he's always assumed the person's perception is the thing that we need to match science against.
Right.
Right. Which means that your perception of your pain is the gold standard. You do not need any scan results to prove that you have pain, because right. your perception is the only thing that matters here.
Right. right.
And there's science behind that.
So it's going to take a few minutes to unwind this one, but I want to jump to the next discussion here. And Dr. Epikarian's lecture to our group in Seattle, he came up personally and talked to us. And he also has been on our Wednesday group and lectured to us. And I've heard him talk personally. So that there's a connection in the brain, and I'm going to simplify it, but I'll ask you to go up again with it. There's a connection in the brain between the thinking brain and the survival brain, that when that connection exists on functional MRI scan, there's a 70 to 80% chance with a new injury, you're going to develop chronic pain. So that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, is that, am I correct on that?
And one of the things that we think is responsible for that is feedback loops in the brain, circuits in the brain that become, I want to use the word calcified, but they become so efficient at processing information between them that they no longer take in external information to update the internal system.
Okay.
So, yeah. So in that sense, you need new experiences to challenge that internal circuit.
Right.
And one of the things that also maintains that internal circuit is anxiety.
So let me, okay, here's my hypothesis. And this has started about 6 weeks ago. And I'll talk to you more, and I'm going to talk to Dr. Carey more. But when I heard that initially, I'm going, wait a second. So why is that circuit there? So you have a person with chronic pain. Let's say you have a back injury. You haven't had a prior injury. You have this circuit in your brain. And again, just to be clear, if that circuit's there between the thinking brain and the survival brain, that you have an 80% chance of that pain becoming chronic. That's mm-hmm. a big deal. Yeah. So my hypothesis is that thoughts are sensory input that actually fire up the fight or flight physiology. I call it phantom brain pain. You have these internal spinning circuits that are not responsive to rational control. Mm-hmm. The more you fight them and suppress them, the worse that they get. So as I talk to different people now more clearly, I've said for a long time that the mental pain is a bigger problem, but it also drives threat physiology. So my hypothesis, again, I haven't had a chance to talk to your group more specifically, is that the connection exists because of human consciousness of trying to deal with unpleasant, repetitive thoughts. And so that's my hypothesis, that these unpleasant, repetitive thoughts, with physical pain, we have withdrawal response, the nociceptive pain symptom. With emotional pain, we have no automatic withdrawal response. And when we suppress the thoughts, as you know, they actually damage the hippocampus of the brain. They increase mm-hmm. opioid conditions. The thoughts become stronger. So if you experience the thoughts or suppress them, either way, the body's fired up. So to me, the inability to escape our consciousness is a huge problem. So that's my hypothesis, is why that circuit exists in the first place. I've been thinking about this for a couple of years since I heard Dr. Epikarian. So what are your thoughts on that?
The thing that I would say is that the negative emotions are required to make those thoughts as potent as they are. And let me...
Exactly. It's bidirectional.
And let me reframe this also from the perspective of the neuroscience emotional learning literature. From that perspective, the brain is organized naturally to... entrain onto and make more efficient neural pathways that are strongly emotional. And for whatever reason, our brains respond much more easily to negative emotion than positive emotion. So negative emotion is like a super strong reinforcement cue. So One of the things I like to say whenever someone has had chronic pain is your body has done nothing wrong. Your pain, for instance, the pain nociceptors, the spinal cord, even the brain are naturally organized to amplify the incoming signals. And your brain is naturally designed, however it was designed, to amplify negative emotional tracks because those are important for survival.
Right.
And what it becomes is a more efficient pathway in the brain. The more you use these loops, the more you use these internal circuits, the more efficient they become. So the neutral way of posing this is whenever someone has a lot of anxiety around pain, their brain has become very efficient, effective at processing that kind of information because the brain views that as emotionally and evolutionarily incredibly important. And not in, and the brain does not want to forget that unless there is new information coming in that you're safe. Without that new information coming in, it has no reason to abandon those really well reinforced circuits.
Right.
So it's an efficiency. And also from the scientific aspect, it's even called this process is experience dependent learning. And this is
called, say that again, please.
Experience dependent learning, which means it's learning that is dependent on incoming experiences, essentially.
Right.
Whenever you have new input that creates this new model, this mental model, that is what is reinforced. And it happens even at the synaptic level, even between neuron to neuron, where they become potentiated. And there are neurochemical processes, physiological processes that make this a really potent, a potent way to, I would say, imprint the emotional memories, but they can be changed. And if anyone is interested on that, they should look into the research of memory reconsolidation. Because one of the most beautiful things about emotional learning, and in my opinion, chronic pain, because it is emotional, there are also rules to unraveling these emotional memories.
So I mean, it makes sense because, I mean, I don't have to learn to not touch a hot stove every time I walk past the stove. And so I don't need to try to make friends with my childhood bully.
Yeah.
And those are very deeply embedded experiences. And you're right, the more emotionally that they get embedded, the stronger the response and the better the chances of survival. Mm-hmm. But let me say a couple of things that are very simplistic and just see if I'm somewhat on base. Okay, so again, we're trying to get rid of the word anxiety. It's a state that's created when you're in fight or flight. You're mm-hmm. nervous, you're upset, whatever it is. So we're trying to, again, get rid of that word. Just use the word activated threat physiology. And anger is hyperactivated threat physiology. And that reaction, the body processes, I think from your lab, about 20 to 40 million bits of information per second unconsciously. And the conscious brain processes about 40. It's about a million to one ratio. So you can't control anxiety and anger, the automatic hardwired responses. And with repetition, of course, you know, you learn how to not touch a hot stove. That gets memorized. You don't have to learn that every time. And then your conscious brain is just a fraction of the survival response. So I said for a long time that there's two parts to healing. One is learn how to calm down the physiology, process adversity. And the other one is to nurture joy. And you're right, the survival reactions are powerful, they're strong, and they override the joy pathways. Plus, how many of us are taught to nurture joy?
Very few.
Right. So to me, the solving chronic pain means you learn to calm down the circuits. And I think what you just said was really powerful is that when you're fighting off anxiety and anger, first of all, we know physiologically your brain goes offline. You're in the limbic system, not the thinking brain. So you need some space to be curious and move forward. Mm-hmm. So as you learn how to create that space, in other words, lowering your threat physiology, then you have the space to move into curiosity, creativity, new thoughts, new patterns. And that's where the healing actually occurs, is you move away from the pain. If you're trying to fix the pain, you're actually reinforcing the circuits.
Mm-hmm.
Am I?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, yes. Yeah.
And that's sort of the simplistic approach I tell my patients. And I just want to make sure I'm somewhat accurate when I say that. And that so that resonates with you.
That does resonate with me. And I like the emphasis on detaching from the thoughts, because as soon as the conscious mind jumps on the bandwagon with what the subconscious mind is accepting as reality, that just perpetuates all these loops. So right. What we have control over. So for instance, we do have some influence on the subconscious through calming activities that amplify the parasympathetic nervous system. That's, to my knowledge, the most effective tools right. we have to control that part. But then there's also of the conscious mind creating even the gap, the detachment, the disengagement, removing the attention from the meaning that is being promoted by the subconscious mind is the first step. So from
all... Can you repeat that for me? This yeah. sounded important.
Okay. The ability to... I feel like the role of attention is very important here. Attention does two things. It focuses your conscious mind on something that is important, and right. it also disengaging from something else. So what you described, this detachment, the taking a break, the disengagement from the meanings that are being promoted by the nervous system, the subconscious meanings, by taking that break and not jumping on the bandwagon with catastrophizing thoughts and emotions, simply by taking a break, you're starting to break that circuit.
Correct. Got it. Okay.
And then slowly, I feel like there are two parts. And one part is the cognitive, the thought disengagement. And then the other that I'm just starting to understand is that all of these subconscious emotion that's coming up, there are meanings. I mean, so one of the tricky things that I've observed in people with chronic pain at this time is that there's a lot of really deep subconscious emotional memories coming up. And there's a danger of gaslighting in that if someone has a history of trauma, and those patterns are imprinted into their nervous system, it is an old truth that's coming up.
Right.
Whenever, so, you know, there's also a part of this in that you can deal with this in some level at the conscious level. And then also there's the question of how to deal with the subconscious aspect whenever part of the subconscious aspect, the hyperactivation of the nervous system is rooted in an older truth. And that's whenever the compassionate witnessing of the emotions seems to be the most powerful, because with the compassionate witnessing, the neutrality, you are then contradicting the fear and the anxiety that's coming up. You're superimposing a neutral state, a neutral emotional state, a neutral mm-hmm. thought state on top of that. Right. And that seems to be able to transform some of that subconscious weight.
Right.
And theoretically, memory reconsolidation theory actually explains why that makes sense from a physiological perspective. So one of the things I think that's very new that isn't well incorporated into chronic pain care is how to deal with, because there are a lot of people that I've talked to who are getting very old emotional memories coming up, and it begs the question, like, why? You know, it's almost like this stuff is coming up to be witnessed. How can we deal with that without just perpetually distracting and shifting the attention away from it?
Right.
Yeah.
So we could talk for a while, and we'll probably do a few more podcasts together. So we didn't get to, there's still a lot more to unpack here with this particular part of the topic about, you know, what to do with it, how to deal with it. And so that's actually my personal interest right now. The next year are these obsessive thought patterns, the connection with emotions, et cetera, how to calm things down. And just briefly, you know, these obsessive thought patterns seem to be perceived to be unsolvable by the mental health world. But that's not true. I had OCD. I have helped many people out of this OCD pathway, but there's four parts. One of them is the thought diversion, which is CBT, mindfulness, expressive writing. The second part is calming down, turning down the heat, turn it on the physiology. I call it anger processing. But when your brain's on fire, the thoughts come out like clay pigeons at a shooting range. So what I don't think the mental health world is acknowledge is the physiology. And so the thought diversion is one thing, the physiology is another. Then finally, you move into circuits that are more enjoyable and pleasant. But again, you can't do that if you're fighting off the threat physiology. Yeah. Then the final part is sort of dissolution of the ego, which is a different topic. But these intrusive thought patterns are solvable, but you can't do it by doing battle with them. It just doesn't work. Right. So anyway, so we're going to talk again about a lot more of this, about the solutions part of it. But you have some resources I'd like to have you share before we close here. So what are some of your resources you're working on right now?
Absolutely. So if you go to www.aivohealth.com, AIVOhealth.com, we have a research study running right now that gives people 3 months free access. And after you finish the 3 months, you get 3 additional months of free access to our program, which is based on the neuroplasticity approach from Vanya Apkarian's research. Okay. And so this is essentially using a tool that was developed from Vanya's research to help identify different psychological patterns that suggest which types of treatments will help you first.
Okay.
So we then offer those within the app.
Okay. So so I'm also intrigued because, you know, I have this thing called the Doc Journey. We also have an app and a course. Yes. But we're also finding out the number one thing to actually heal is actually get people's brains online enough to heal. Mm-hmm. So my sense is that what we're doing has a lot of synergy to it. Because if somebody's angry and frustrated, their brains are offline, I don't know how to get back online very well. If somebody engages, it's just a matter of time. But that initial engagement to get somebody to actually be open enough to actually start to learn and reprogram is a big deal. So anyway, thank you. I really enjoy this.
And I just want to say that I agree that there's a lot of overlap between what you've put together and what we have. And I think one of the things that we do is we just focus step by step by step. Right. So for instance, I don't see any reason why people, they might find different bits of knowledge, different patterns of growth across many of these apps. Correct. I think that's perfectly reasonable.
Well, my sense is more of a synergy than overlap. I mean, there's a certain framework that I put together, but there's a bunch of things I can't get to. And so I think everybody is individual. Everybody does different.
We're all working on this together.
Yeah, we're all working on it together. So anyway, thank you very much. And we'll talk soon.
Okay. Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank our guest, Melissa Farmer, for being on the show today and sharing the insights she gained about chronic pain from working on the groundbreaking research carried on in Dr. Apkarian's lab. I'm your host, Tom Masters, reminding you to be back next week for another episode of Back in Control Radio with Dr. David Hanscom. And in the meantime, be sure to visit the website at www.backincontrol.com.
Thanks for listening today, and join us next week for Back in Control Radio.